So in the world of meditation, the wide world of meditation from many different spiritual traditions, there are many different kinds of breath meditation, many ways of breathing. Some are quite intentional, some are quite creative, some involve manipulating the breath in all kinds of ways. But it's quite common. The meditations on the breath and sensitivity to breath is very common, and as maybe many of you know, in a wide range of spiritual traditions. And the word for breath is a very important word in many different cultures. Spirit, like spiritual, also comes from the Latin root for breath. So we say respire, to expire, to respire, respiration. It has the word spirit in it. The wonderful expression spiritual aspiration has words breath in both words. And you find, in Indian language, in Chinese languages, in Hebrew languages, Aramaic languages, Greek languages, that the word breath carries a lot of special meanings, connotations. The breath is very central. For some people, breath meditation doesn't work. It's not the right meditation for them. But it's one of the universal forms of meditation. In Buddhism, the usual way of approaching breath meditation is not to manipulate it, even though I encourage some of you to kind of breathe more fully than usual here. But usually it's not a matter of manipulation, but rather a matter of using the breath as a way of developing the mind and kind of condition the body. But to develop the mind, and in particular in one way, and that is to train the mind not to cling. One of the central aspects of Buddhist practice, and some people would say the really heart of what Buddhist practice is all about, is learning not to cling to anything. And the mind clings phenomenally easy. It's like we have this Velcro mind. And, you're thinking about getting a car, and every time some new car drives by you and it just sticks in your mind, the car is long gone, but you're still thinking about it. You see some kind of very special kind of person, you kind of feel attracted, and suddenly that person's long gone, out of your sight, but the fantasy is still there, and you clung to it. The mind clings phenomenally easily. And clinging, the more sensitive the mind is, the more you'll see that clinging is painful for the mind. If you're living a very coarse life, very active and very busy, you might not notice that your clinging has a big toll. You might be so busily clinging, you don't even in grasping at things, and so distracted that you're not even aware that you're distracted. But as you get more sensitive and more present, you'll notice that every movement of clinging involves a feeling of distress, a feeling of suffering, of contraction, of being tightened down, closing up, narrowing of attention, narrowing of consciousness of the mind or the heart. Feeling separate, feeling removed from others, feeling isolated. There's a whole series of constellation of ways we feel that happens as we cling. I don't know of anybody who's actually says their clinging is pleasant, except in the fact that sometimes clinging provides a source of security. And that security then brings a whole slew of other things, like a certain kind of well-being. What we're trying to do in Buddhist practice is discover a sense of well-being, a sense of joy and delight in life that isn't predicated on clinging to anything. Whether it's clinging to a relationship, it's clinging to anything at all. The ultimate aim of Buddhism and the ultimate aim of being a Buddha is someone who has no filters, no obstructions of clinging on their heart and their mind. And it sounds very simplistic to say the goal of Buddhism is not to cling. But if you begin investigating how pervasive clinging functions in the mind, you'll think, wow, that's pretty amazing that some human beings actually are dedicated to not clinging, or that some human beings have actually learned how not to cling at all, how to have a complete openness. Rather than Velcro mind, they have Teflon mind, because then nothing clings to it. Some people get a little bit perturbed and afraid when they hear about non-clinging, because they think that it means being kind of a zombie, or it means being uninterested or indifferent to the world, and uninvolved with the activities of the world. It doesn't mean that at all. all the various functionings of our mind and our heart can still function quite nicely. There can be all kinds of motivations and activities and reactions and feelings to the world around us. But those things can exist with clinging or without clinging. Buddhist practice is really, the heart of Buddhist practice is to let go of this one little, simple thing, clinging. It doesn't mean that, so if you're clinging to, what do people cling to? Help me out. What has one of you clung to today, as an example? Right now, maybe you're clinging to not being embarrassed.
Personal identity.
So, maybe you're a man, so you cling to being a man, and all that associates with it. To let go of clinging means you can still be a man, but you don't cling to the idea of being a man. You don't cling to the concepts and ideas of what it means to be a man. You don't have to let go of the things you're clinging to necessarily, but you can let go of the clinging. Some people, when they enter a spiritual life, feel like they have to abandon, let go of all their wealth and their money and possessions and live a life of radical simplicity. It might be very useful to do that, very helpful to do that at times. But that's not a symbol or a sign or proof that you become spiritual, that you let go of all that and live life by living a life of simplicity. The proof of a spiritual life in Buddhism is that you don't cling. And that doesn't require you getting rid of the things that you were clinging to before. And sometimes there's a confusion between the object of clinging and the clinging. And we attack the object of clinging, as opposed to understanding really where the heart of the practice is, which is the clinging itself. People cling because it gives them a sense of safety sometimes. And I know that the outer reaches, the deepest possibilities of letting go of clinging is phenomenally frightening to some people. And they feel like they can't trust that. And one of the things we're learning in Buddhist practice is learning to trust coming from a place of non-clinging. It's okay to enter into the world not clinging to things, not always kind of holding on to certain ways how things have to be done, or planning ahead in some clinging way. Or it's okay to enter the world without clinging. And if you try that in a radical way as an experiment for 1 hour, just choose some hour in the middle of your day and say, okay, this is the hour I'm going to try absolutely non-clinging, but really pay attention and see how long you can last before you get afraid. Is this okay? I can't do this. It's not safe. And that's a very fascinating place to explore, that edge, that meeting place, because part of the function of clinging is to protect us from our fear. But without confronting our fear, there's no spiritual life, in Buddhism at least. So you have to sooner or later be willing to edge yourself into and explore that terrain where your fear begins to come into play, and massaging it. Maybe don't go into the full-fledged, the greatest fear you have. Begin massaging that edge of your fear so that you can learn how to feel more comfortable, more trusting, in a place of non-clinging. Meditation on the breath is a great help for learning not to cling. Because, let me kind of get it from another angle, this whole discussion. If it's not too confusing. What we care about in our life is really important. Not only what we care about, but the fact that we care to begin with. And a lot of what the training and attention that we use in mindfulness is a training in choosing to put our attention, put our care into what's important for us. To have some choice about what we care about or are caring. All of us have, in a sense, this capacity to care. And what happens often is that our capacity to care is hijacked by our clinging, by our preoccupations, by all kinds of things. So you're driving down the freeway and you see this wonderful billboard that shows a picture of, most of us couldn't care less about B2B billboards they have lining the street there now these days. But say there's a billboard for a Palm Pilot. And it could be anything, right? And so you're going along and you see this picture of the Palm Pilot, and you notice after 5 minutes, you've spent 5 minutes fantasizing about how wonderful it would be to have a Palm Pilot. Your care, your capacity to care, has been hijacked and pulled into kind of a subconscious automatic pilot, being lost, being caught by the concern about Palm Pilot. Whatever it is, we're driving along, we're going along in our life, and much of our time is spent with our care, our caring, of hijacked by our preoccupations. The movement of learning not to, and being preoccupied is a movement of clinging. You don't get preoccupied unless you cling. It's very subtle, it's a very different kind of clinging than clinging to, you know, gross things, but it's a kind of clinging. When your mind gets preoccupied, your capacity to care has been hijacked and is lost. And the more time we spend in our life preoccupied and lost in our thoughts, our capacity to care has been lost. It's kind of like it's being used as food for preoccupation. What we're trying to do in Buddhist practice is to liberate our care, our caring, our capacity to care, so we can bring that food of caring into our life in a useful way. So we can care about our breath, we can care about our body, we can care about the world around us, so that we can tend to it, so we can nourish it, so we can be present for it, so that we bring attention to it. Attention, some people equate attention with love. And if our attention is present and alert and wakeful, then the love is there. But if our capacity for attention or caring or attending to things is hijacked by preoccupation, it precludes any possibility of love, for example. So the breath meditation, so the mind tends to be preoccupied very easily. By bringing the attention to something as simple as the breath, you're training your attention. You're kind of holding your attention on something which is not your preoccupation. Most people don't get attached to the breath, though you can be. And so you're trying to stay settled on the breath and not waver from the breath, not let the mind move from the breath. Kind of a steadiness, what's called sometimes one-pointedness on the breath. Just stay with the breath body, with the breath sensations of breath. Some people complain that the breath seems like the most boring, mundane thing that ever they encountered. Why do Buddhists follow the breath, tend to the breath? Once you get into the breath becomes incredibly alive and, you know, wonderful. You can't imagine something more delightful. But in the beginning, it's just a training to let go of our preoccupations, whether it's to emotions or feelings or thoughts or memories or planning, whatever it is. The mind has this tremendous kind of momentum into those kinds of that track. And each time you bring your mind to stay in the breath, you're countering the forces of distraction, of preoccupation. And each time you do it, you weaken a little bit the habitual feeding and supporting of preoccupation. And as they say, it might seem very insignificant, you know, each moment you bring yourself back, but with enough drops, the bath time gets filled. Each moment of holding your attention with the breath and coming back and be willing to let go of your preoccupation. Oh, there I am thinking again. Gently come back and be with the breath. Be with the breath. And then sustaining the attention with the breath over time, our preoccupations, our care is going into the breath in an active way. And our care, our attention, our love is not being hijacked by other things. And at first, for a long time perhaps, you'll find yourself keep getting hijacked. But slowly, what happens is two things will happen. You build up strength of being able to choose where your attention goes. So you have some power over what you care about. So you can stay with what you care about. You can stay with what you want, where you want your attention to be. It's a kind of a power that you develop. The other thing that happens is the forces of distraction become weaker. The fears, the anxiety, the desires, the ambitions, the whatever it is that kind of fuels our preoccupation is not getting fed and supported by ongoing repetition. And so it begins actually to weaken and gets weaken and weaken and weaken. If you stop meditating then it can, you know, you can, you know, you tendencies, we start feeding again those tendencies. But as you meditate, you begin training yourself to be different. You're training the mind to have a strong attention that can stay and care about what it wants to care about. And you're weakening all the forces of distraction. Weakening force of distraction is, in a sense, weakening our clinging. But as we become less preoccupied and less distracted, then we can also start noticing ways in which we cling, even when we're not distracted. And part of the function of learning how to be in the present moment is when we start noticing very carefully the wide range of things that makes us tick, that happens within us, the motivations, the thoughts, the values, the worldview, the assumptions, the emotions and feelings that are operating right now that we're kind of clinging to, kind of stuck on, that are kind of propelling us and compelling us to act and think and talk in certain ways. So that staying with the breath is a great way of learning how to slowly let go of things. Let go of things and let go of things. The more you can stay with the breath, the more it tends to help this conditioning, the softening and calming of our attachments. And it's really, really helpful to learn to stay with the breath. It's not easy to stay with the breath. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to give you an alternative way of being with the breath today. Some people find that it's most helpful to stay just with the breath in one place. It's less complicated, just kind of just... Some people are more like kind of... They just like to root themselves in one place and stay there and not move. But some people find it's more useful to kind of be with the whole breath body. It's more organic, it's more kind of fills our being, it's more movement, it's more... kind of feels more intimate, more alive, more comforting perhaps to be in the whole breath body. And so you might experiment with these two different modes. And different times, different modes are most appropriate. It might be at times when you're really stressed and you have a lot of tension in your body, that breathing through the whole body, as if the whole body is an organ of breathing, is the most useful. And times when you're quite settled and calm, it might be the most useful is actually to narrow and limit where you pay attention to. So you can really be more one-pointed in one place. And that helps you get more and more concentrated and centered in the present moment. How you come back to the breath when you get lost, when your mind gets hijacked, is a very important issue. Some people who meditate will often notice that their mind has been lost for a while. And then if you've kind of taking these spiritual teachings too seriously, then you notice that your mind has been distracted. And you say, oh, shoot. Or you might say it more strongly than that. You know, and either, you know, you get angry or upset. It could be very, you know, a little, you know, a little irritation or a little impatience. Or it could be that this is, you refer it back to yourself. I can't do this. I'm just, you know, a disaster to Buddhism, you know. You know, everyone else is doing it, but you know, I just am completely incompetent. And something as simple as the breath, we make some statement about ourselves. You know, we get complicated. We judge. We get irritated. We get impatient. All these things might happen. It's all unnecessary. And it's important to notice that tendency of what we do when we notice we've been lost, so we can learn to start simplifying our relationship to getting lost. Just lost. Nothing more has to happen but notice, oh, I drifted off in thought. Doesn't have to be any great conclusions or any judgments or any contractions because of it. And then some people, when they notice they drifted off from the breath, will jerk their mind back to the breath, or they'll pounce back on the breath. There's no need for that. It can be very, it's supposed to be a non-violent practice. And there's various ways of kind of beginning again with the breath. And I'll give you a couple of options if it's not too complicated. One is, don't bring your mind back to the breath. Just very, very generously, very openly, notice at that moment whether you're breathing in or breathing out. Because when you have the notion you're bringing the mind back, you have to move the mind. It's kind of like you have to jerk the mind. But the awareness doesn't actually need to be moved. Awareness is just everywhere all the time. And you can just kind of relax and just notice. And it becomes to you, in a sense, oh, I'm inhaling. And then you don't have to do this kind of like little energetic thing with the mind. Oh, you know, okay, got to bring it back. It's more like you're then relaxing and letting awareness be broad and letting the breath return to awareness. So it's more like, rather than bringing your mind back to, returning your mind, your attention to the breath, you're letting the breath return to your awareness. Okay, I've been lost. Okay, let's let the breath return here. It can be a lot more peaceful to do that way. But some people like the idea of bringing the mind back. So you can, it's okay to do that. I mean, a lot of people do it, and it's great success. And but another way of doing it is to float the mind back then. So the mind is floated off into distraction. In the same kind of speed and way in which the mind is floated off in distraction, just gently float it back to the breath. And if it kind of floated back, you take your time, take a couple of seconds, you know, okay. Then it feels much more pleasant and more enjoyable, the whole process. The jerking doesn't feel very enjoyable. And if it's not enjoyable, then the mind doesn't want to do it. You know, well, why would mind want to do anything that, you know, well, you're kind of being judgmental? You're kind of like you're building in your failure by just the very way in which some people kind of, oh, I got it back. Oh, did it wrong. Got to get back. Hope no one noticed. So how you relate to the mind being distracted is a very important part of coming back. Then being back or being with the breath, it's very useful to sustain the attention through time. Some people are very good of bringing the attention to the breath initially, the initial application of the mind on the breath. But once they're there, they get complacent. And then very quickly the mind wanders off again. Part of the art of meditation is to sustain our caring, to sustain our love or our attention on that breath through time. And then the art then is learning how to do that in a way that feels welcoming or feels nice for the mind to do that. If you're being tight and forced and, you know, and demanding, and you know, the mind doesn't want to stay present then. But if there's feeling of welcoming, of joy, of delight, of interest, of feeling of this is nurturing or tending, or this is a form of caring, or that this is inspiring to do it, or if you create kind of a milieu where it's kind of feels like a good thing for the mind feels welcomed or invited, then it'll want to stay around. But if you create a tight, contracted, kind of forceful, demanding kind of way, then the mind is not going to want to stay around. It's going to want to go out and do something else. But you have to apply yourself some degree. There has to be some strength of application. And the art, part of the art of meditation is learning how to apply kind of strength to the practice without that strength being straining or forceful or tight. So the art is how to be relaxed and strong at the same time. Relaxed and dedicated. Relaxed and engaged at the same time. One of the ways of practicing, trusting, not clinging, is to hang in there with the breath no matter what else arises in your meditation. Nothing else is more important. You know, there's other ways of meditating, but just stay with the breath, stay with the breath, stay with the breath. And you have all other kind of thoughts and concerns, I'm not going to pick them up. I'm not going to get involved. I'm going to keep my caring with the breath for this half an hour or whatever long time you're sitting. So I think that's enough of my words for now. So now it's your turn to, if you have comments or questions about anything, or if you want to talk a little bit, report. I'm very curious to hear what it was like for some of you to do this breath body meditation. For some of you, it might have been new to do it this way, and if it was helpful or difficult to do, or it'd be nice to hear. More questions about it you might have? Yes?
I found the one-pointed meditation, I don't have to trust myself. I can just stay with one thing. Whereas with the more amorphous, I think part of that for me and why it's such a problem is because the level of trust I have to have in going from different places everywhere. And actually, sometimes I can generate the most, you know, the greatest feeling of relaxation. And if I, you know, completely tense up and focus right on the, you know, one thing. And it occurred to me that this can't be right. I mean, this is not the way. Like, this can't be the right way to. So I'm trying, even with the one point, I'm trying to be relaxed but dedicated. But for me, the reason to be with the sauna meditation is so difficult is to trust in the work.
Yeah, I think it's really, but it's really key. I mean, it's the. If you find your old way helps you get concentrated, what you might do is try it for a little while, 15 minutes, and then let go, but then switch once you're calm and settled because of the more forceful way you're doing it. But it's possible to focus on the breath, like focusing on one place and getting one point of concentration with clinging as part of it, clinging to that. And if a person's very task-oriented and always, you know, it's always kind of pushing and to get ahead. They can bring that to the meditation also, and they can get quite concentrated, being quite ambitious and quite demanding and pushing and striving. It's possible, but that kind of striving might entail, and underneath, a kind of fear about life, fear of opening up to life, and also by staying with one point in the body. That point might feel very safe. Some people need safety for a while, so it's good to choose a place that feels good until you feel nice, a lot of safety. But some people don't need more safety. Some people need to confront the places of their fear. And by choosing some one place in the body, you might be avoiding everything else that's in your body. Because our fear is often held in our body in various ways. And doing the whole breath body means that your whole emotional body, you know, all the places in the physical, all the muscles get held and tight and are being massaged or worked with awareness. And that you have to become aware of them. And that can be very disconcerting also. But with time, keeping it up, it is a kind of conditioning factor that slowly you get to both learn how to trust and also learn to look at these things very honestly. Does that speak to your thing?
Yes, it does. One additional question, that is, I've read that there's an important difference between the states of total absorption that can come with, I guess, regular practice, and sort of witness consciousness that's characteristic of vipassana meditation, and that at some point every meditator has to make a decision to move from one to the other. And the states that are associated with one point in this are substantially different than the witness consciousness or observant ego qualities that come through. Do you think that's true, that at some point you have to, or you, what you're saying is you can really do, or as an exercise, do 15 minutes of one point of this and then come back to the other? But do you feel like choice has to be made, or it's not that
here? The classic way of doing is called vipassana, is to do concentration practice first, and then once the mind is quite steady and stable, then to switch over to do the mindfulness practice. But there are other ways of doing it, in the way that the primary way in which Spirit Rock and IMS and the kind of tradition I'm part of was trained in Asia, was to actually just do the vipassana straight out and not do the preliminary concentration practice. Different minds are, and I might be contradicting myself as I respond to you, so you have to be forgiving of me. The different minds have different tendencies in this direction. Some people's minds tend towards more concentration, and it's very hard for them to do the mindfulness. And some minds are very much into the mindfulness, the awareness, the vipassana, and it's very hard for them to get concentrated. And so they don't have to make any choice. It's like their choice has been made for them. And if you do it, if you do the mindfulness practice, if you're really good at it, you don't need to develop concentration separately. Concentration comes with that practice. Some people, not enough concentration comes with the Vipassana practice, and then it's helpful to kind of do a little bit of concentration practice to build up enough momentum just before you switch over. In textbook discussions of meditation, there tends to be a very sharp divide between these two, Vipassana and concentration or absorption practices. And I think in real, and to some degree, the initial path of practice is kind of like a Y. Initially, it doesn't really matter which one you're on, because when you're on the leg of the Y, it's like everybody's dealing with the same stuff, and it doesn't really matter. But at some point, there is a kind of sense you can choose to one or the other. You can go to more absorption or more mindfulness. And sometimes a teacher will encourage you to do one more than the other, or help you at that point of juncture. But I find myself a little bit reluctant to kind of go along completely with that idea of a juncture, because the textbook description of these two being radically different, I think, is a little bit overdone. It's too easy. There's a big overlap between these two worlds. And to say that witness consciousness, being a pure observer of just observing clearly, is radically different from the absorptions, is not quite accurate. And and to say that you don't get into deep states of absorption with very strong witnessing, as you do in Vipassana, is also inaccurate. So there's a kind of big overlap. So I don't know if I managed to confuse you or everyone. Is this helpful? But generally, you know, if someone coming off the street, like coming here to Palo Alto on Thursday night, you know, get as concentrated as you want. Just go for it, you know. And get as mindful as you want. Just, you know, don't worry about it. And then as you kind of get more into the practice and start doing retreats and stuff, then you'll talk to your teacher and you might get some specific guidance. But for you, well, it sounds like the cutting edge for you would not be the concentration, but rather the mindfulness. Right, right. What happens with concentration is that some people have a capacity of getting concentrated, but there can be not very much self-understanding that comes with that. And so that you get concentrated, it's very pleasant, and people get attached to that pleasantness, and if they associate that concentrated state with being a spiritual thing, then they identify with that, and there's a lot of attachment. But then as they leave that concentrated state, all the tendencies to being egotistical or being greedy or being hateful or spiteful or fearful are still operating. And so the people just want to run away from normal life and get back into a concentrated state where they feel comfortable and spiritual again. Sooner or later, the person has to confront who they really are and not always be going into some pleasant state. And so we have to be willing to spend maybe a lot of time being uncomfortable also, so we can really see what's going on. And then rather than doing a spiritual bypass to wonderful, pleasant spiritual states, you go through the difficulty and resolve them, and then you can stay there much more in a more realistic way.
You mentioned earlier about being relaxed and engaged. And even in my fantasy world, I don't really have a sense of that. And I was wondering if you'd want to elaborate any more about being engaged and relaxed.
The classic example that's given in the text is imagine that you have a big ceramic pot filled with oil to the brim. And you're walking, you're carrying it on your head like they do some traditional cultures, you know, supporting on your head, walking. And you're walking through a very crowded marketplace. And you have to walk balancing this vase, this bowl, this pot on your head without spilling any of the oil. So you have to be very attentive. You can't miss a beat. But you also have to be very relaxed, because if you're tense, then, you know, it's not going to work either. So you have to be very relaxed and very alert at the same time. So that's a classic example of how both things have to operate. So there has to be a real, real strength of presence.
Are there any like beginner?
You have an example?
I think.
Oh, you just commiserating.
Swing dancing. Couple dancing, actually.
Great.
When you dance with someone and you have to follow them, mm-hmm. what they're leading.
How about a young child that plays? I think the example of it, like if you watch a child playing, just kind of happening peacefully, even by herself or himself, to me they're relaxed and engaged at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's a very good one, and Elizabeth is an artist, so I would think that you would know about this balance in your art.
Well, I guess I was thinking engaged with other people.
Oh, that's the advanced course.
Well, you know, going back to what you said in the beginning, that doing this whole breath body thing, I mean, immediately talking about not being relaxed and trying not to be engaged, it brought into incredibly sharp focus really fast in a very intense and pretty much unpleasant way. An incredible amount of tension that I was holding in my chest and the back of my throat. And it was kind of fun because, well, fun in an unpleasant way. The rest of my body was fine, you know, but every time I kind of came up to this area, it was like whacking against something, you know, like really whacking against something solid. So,
what some people will do when they notice a particular place of tension or holding, is that you use the breath body as a feeling, as kind of a gentle massage, kind of stretching it as you breathe in, or kind of just touching it.
I believe you. Eventually, it did whatever I brought to it. Yeah. Some massaging.
But you see, there's two things in meditation, right? One is that you can use meditation to kind of help you put yourself in a better state and let go of things. And in mindfulness practice, all we're doing is cultivating our capacity to be present for things as they are. And so it's actually a little bit heretical in pure mindfulness practice to say, nothing, it didn't work. Meaning, it didn't go away.
Right. Well, I finally settled down with that. Because you said, trying to do on the exhale, let go.
Yeah.
The more I'd exhale, the more it would show up. So yeah. I finally said, oh, well, there it is.
Great.
Thank you. For a while.
Good. Thank you. Yes?
You said earlier we should just take an hour in a day and try not to cling.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more how to do that?
Well, it takes a lot of attention. So you have to be mindful. But it means choosing an hour someplace and noticing whatever you do in your mind, your speech, your behavior that has clinging in it. Where you maybe, you come to and you're driving your car and you come to it, the light turns yellow. Clinging means you're trying to push your way through. You come to, you're going down down the supermarket aisles and you know what you have to buy, but you notice this wonderful chocolate that's there. And you know, you didn't have to buy it, you don't even like, whatever. And so you know, suddenly this clinging for chocolate arises, or you find yourself, you pay attention to what you want to say, and you notice you're not simply telling someone something because it's good information for them, that it's very important for them to know, but rather what you're doing, you're trying to build up yourself, you're trying to present yourself, because you have a certain clinging to your self-identity. So you're saying something about yourself. Oh, let me tell you about this wonderful restaurant I ate at. It isn't that so much they need to know about wonderful restaurants. Like, maybe it's like, oh, you should really notice me, that I'm a great chooser of restaurants. It's a kind of clinging. So there's all kinds of ways to pay attention to what we say, how we act, how we think. If you're in a hurry suddenly, if you're trying to get things done quickly, if you're trying to avoid certain things, clinging is operating. So it's a really radical thing. I mean, if you did it for an hour, well, you'd be a Buddha by the end. So you can't do it well, but you do the best you can. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I think so.
But I would encourage you to take it on, definitely. I remember some years ago I taught a class where I encourage people to do something like this. But there I said, choose some situation, maybe for an hour or something, some situation, maybe it's a little bit unusual for you, or maybe have someone else choose for you, where you take the assumption that that in this situation, nothing has to be any different than how it is. It's okay the way it is. So I think the way this one person came back and said, oh, I went to this party, and my husband told me this is the hour. And she said it was really fascinating to be there at this party, as if nothing had to be any different. You know, no one's talking to me, nothing has to be any different. Or everyone wants to talk to me, or, you know, it's all the, you know, this person's talking to me, I can't believe this person's talking to me, and whatever, you know. So just, this is the hour. Someone else came and said that, you know, I think things weren't working out well, like the bus or the airplane was late or something, and oh, this was going to be the hour they were going to practice that. Yes, please.
Maybe I misunderstood what you were just saying, but like if you were to have this thinking that everything is just okay the way it is, then how would you ever go about making any improvements in your life?
Oh, this is just an experiment for 1 hour.
It's not
a good policy to always have that kind of idea. But because most of us operate so radically in the other extreme end of that, that to take 1 hour, choose a safe hour, you know, choose something that's relatively, you know, and use your common sense. I mean, don't just, you know, don't make stupid mistakes around this area. But just take 1 hour where you kind of really operate on that premise that everything is fine the way it is, as a kind of an experiment to notice what happens in your mind when you're doing that. To notice what things you normally, the way you normally operate, automatically you don't really see so clearly, because now you're going to operate a different way. And you might find out that you can operate that way much more than you usually do. And you might learn a lot about your fear and your preoccupation. So rather than getting into some big philosophical issue about you can't operate really that way because there's all this injustice in the world, the exercise is not meant to be a philosophical statement about the nature of life. It's just, it's like a game you play for an hour.
Also, I guess kind of extending it, just related to that, how do you differentiate between clinging versus an okay or healthy desire to change something?
Yeah, that's
pretty close cousins, aren't there?
That's a very good question. There'll be other things will come along with a desire that has clinging as part of it. If it's just a neutral desire, it's a desire, then there will be no expectation, no demand, no disappointment, no irritation, no impatience, no contraction of the mind around it, no forcefulness, no ambition. There's all these other things that actually feel kind of painful to arise when there's clinging. And desire by itself doesn't have those. So if you notice that you were expecting an outcome, then there's clinging. You know, if you feel impatient or feel irritated because a desire isn't fulfilled, then there's been clinging as part of it. But if you know, if I feel hungry, it's very easy for me to have a desire. I discovered this nice Indian restaurant recently, so now I'm thinking the next time I go eat, I'd like to go eat that place again. That's a nice desire. It's a fine desire to have. Nothing wrong with that desire. And but if I then I can cling to that desire, which it's really important to get there. I really like that pleasure that I got there, and I make go drive all the way across town to get there and show up on Monday, and they're closed on Mondays. I get all upset, and you know, then I know that I'm clinging to it. But, you know, it's a nice desire to have. If it's easy to fulfill, great. And if it's not easy to fulfill, I'm quite fine eating my peanut butter sandwich. You know, just... Last one, yes.
The problem I have a lot is to start into the meditation, and then I get sort of relaxed, and then I have a hard time not going to sleep. And sort of.
What do you think would happen to you if you stayed awake?
Well, if I stayed, I don't fall asleep, let's put it that way. I usually fall over. My head goes down. It can be uncomfortable.
So if I ask that question again and just let kind of your gut answer rather than your mind, what do you think would happen to you if you stayed awake in your meditation? Doesn't compute.
I mean, I'm aware that it's the, what strikes me is that I'm supposed to be awake, so it's wrong to fall off and fall over and sleep. So
I remember when I was in the monastery, I used to fall asleep a lot, and then at some point I noticed that I wasn't sleeping anymore, and it occurred to me, what's wrong with me? I'm no longer relaxed. Maybe I'm tense. I can't fall asleep anymore. The causes of falling asleep are varied in meditation. Some people, there's a lot of people in our local culture are sleep deprived. It's kind of famous now. And so some people need to sleep more than need to meditate. And if you're really sleepy, then some people try to meditate. Now, in addition to being sleep deprived, maybe they try meditating after eating a big meal, which also can add to sleepiness and be easy to fall asleep. Sometimes sleepiness is a sign of being relaxed too much, and then it's a matter of learning how to moderate the effort in the practice and maybe bring a little more alertness or effort, both physical effort, sit up straighter, maybe even open the eyes, but also kind of mental effort of trying to bring more alertness, more clarity, more investigation to what your present moment experience is. So the mind is more engaged rather than complacent. Sometimes when people meditate and they get relaxed, they're actually leaning into and savoring and enjoying that feeling of relaxation. And savoring the feeling of relaxation in meditation is not meditation. It's kind of a clinging. It's fine to have nice feelings of relaxation in meditation, but you don't want to lean into it and hold on to it and use it to comfort you. Because if you do that, it tends to put you to sleep. So you want to look and see what your relationship is to the nice feelings that come with relaxation. What we really want to keep developing is the clarity of seeing. Also, people tend to fall asleep sometimes because there's unresolved strong emotions or feelings or conflicts that they don't want to look at. And sometimes the body has this amazing protective mechanism of falling asleep rather than looking at difficulties. You see it in babies. It's kind of where the babies will, if you put the babies in an environment where there's a lot of stimulus, a lot of noise, they seem to protect themselves from all that by falling asleep. As adults, we tend to do that also, but it tends to be from our inner noise. And so sometimes it's a matter of looking at, very carefully, what are the emotions or thoughts or memories that seem to flash up the moment before you start falling asleep. And there might be a little window there to see that actually what's happening is you're turning yourself off so you don't have to face those things.
Well, I'm actually aware that usually I start to think about something else. If I'm sort of concentrating on the breath, and as soon what I notice is as soon as my thought goes to something other than the breath, I will fall asleep. Yeah? And I notice that time again.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what that's about, but that's what happens. Uh-huh. And it's like, as soon as I lose my mind, ventures that I can see.
Have you tried keeping your eyes open?
Sometimes, yes.
What happens then? Do you stay awake?
Well, actually, I guess I haven't. I've tried counting.
Try meditating then with your eyes open. And either open down to 45 degrees and see if that works, kind of looking at nothing, but just the floor or something. Or if that doesn't work, keep your eyes kind of gazing up towards a kind of place, some kind of light source, like the sky or bright window or something. You keep your eyes up a little bit. And then continue your mindfulness and see if maybe you can then stay alert. And then if your mind does drift away, you're more likely to catch it and stay and come back and be present. It can be for some people very challenging, the whole area of falling asleep, and a very, very fruitful area of practice. And if you do fall asleep and you wake up after a while, don't beat yourself up for it. Rather, there's also some magical moments of very useful insight that can happen after we wake up from having been asleep. So it's very important then to begin the mindfulness the best you can. Okay, what's happening with me right now? Investigate that. So just before you fall asleep and just after are important moments in practice.
Okay. It's tough because usually I'm sitting straight up and if I fall asleep, I'm going to fall out of the chair.
Sure.
So
no.
That awareness comes to
me. Yeah, it could well be. Well, you could do the Jack Kornfield approach, and that is you put your chair at the, on the edge of some big wall, you know, some big cliff. You know, maybe like 100 or 200 feet or something. And or if you don't want to, you know, if that seems a little bit too far to fall, maybe put it at the edge of a pool, you know, of water. You know, and make sure you wear really good clothes, you know, and your suit, and sit there at the edge of the water. And then, you know, maybe that's enough to keep you awake. So let's end with a short sitting. So next week, most likely I won't be here, and most likely Shanti Soul is going to come and give the talk, lead the group. And Shanti is a Vipassana teacher in the lineage of Ruth Dennison. And she's someone who's much loved in our community because for many years she was, still is periodically, the a cook for the retreats that we go teach. And she has a whole wonderful spirit of service and love of the Dharma and dedication to bringing the practice into work and into movement, activity. So it's so it's likely that Shanti will come next week, and I should be back again the following week. So may you all breathe happily, and may your clinging slowly decrease. Thank you.